Now, truth is a controversial word in our time. It's a controversial word because as contemporary people, as educated, enlightened postmoderns, people of our time, we have a somewhat ambivalent relationship to the idea of truth. Many of us wonder if there really is such a thing as the truth, as truth, and if there is, if it's really possible to know the truth at all. And there's a reason that we have that frame. There's a reason that we doubt the very notion of truth, or even if we believe in truth, we doubt whether we can see it. And it has to do with the historical cultural evolution of humanity. You know, we came through a period, what's often been called the traditional phase of our emergence, of our evolution of human consciousness, when there were a lot of big absolute truths being thrown around, usually that had come down through in the form of revelation by some kind of wisdom holder who said, this is the truth, these are the commandments, this is the law, this is the book. And we saw how, on the one hand, that this emergence of the notion of an absolute truth that we can line up with, we see how that helped humanity evolve out of a very kind of primitive, kind of hostile, it's very self-centered, very power-oriented, kind of very me first, or just me and my little clan first kind of way of living. We saw humanity emerge into much higher organizing structures, the ability for large groups of people to begin to align and come together around a truth with a capital T. But then we also saw the abuse of this. We saw it throughout history, the incredible abuses of that came from those who were wielding their notion of absolute truth. And we saw it over and over again. And ultimately, you know, we saw the scientific, you know, revolution and the Western Enlightenment breakthrough and question those traditional truths that were being held and used to rule people, and the kind of freedom of truth start to emerge, of scientific truth seeking. But then we again saw even that kind of truth being abused. We even saw the truth of evolution quickly being abused by people saying, well, if humans evolve, some of us are more evolved than others, and then those who are more evolved can dominate those who are less evolved. And, you know, that led to a further discrediting of any kind of notion of truth. And in a sense, all this culminated in the kind of core emergence of postmodernism, or this core, which some of you may know that term well, others may not, but essentially the core insight of postmodernism, one of the main core insight, was that our perception of reality is always interpretation. It's always being colored by filters and biases, cultural assumptions and preconceptions. So we can't really know what's true. And this basic insight, which is a very true insight and important insight about how anybody claiming to have the truth is probably seeing that through some kind of filter, and probably and very often that holding of truth is motivated by some kind of agenda that they want to prove, and so they're, you know, emphasizing certain aspects of truth over other aspects. So that core insight, very essential, but it led to this what's known as pluralism or relativism, or this notion that, well, we can't really know the truth, so therefore we all just have our own truth, our own personal truth, which really just means we all have our own opinion, our own interpretation, and nobody's is more accurate than anybody else's, and nobody, you know, can claim to have a higher truth or be closer to the truth than anybody else. We're all just equally flawed in our perceptions, and just kind of, it's what created what Ken Wilber called flatland, which is a flattening out of any distinctions in ability to see the truth, ability to judge, you know, higher values, value hierarchies, etc. And so that's what's led to the current predicament we're in, where all of us on probably some level, when we hear the word truth thrown around, we say, well, what do you mean, Jimmy? Who's truth, Craig? And who's to, and even if you say, well, maybe there is truth, who's to say what's true? That's always the next question. Well, who's to say what's true? How do we know? Who's going to be the judge? Is that, you know, going to be the priests or the kings, the next ruling class? Is it you, Craig? You're going to tell us the truth, right? So this is where we are. And it's a step in our human evolution to come to this questioning of any assertion of truth, this willingness to question it all. It's a good place. But it's not the end of the story, you see, because at the same time, even as we might have this, you know, is there really truth? Can I really know truth? At the same time, if we look deep within ourselves into our own spiritual longing, our spiritual impulse, the part of us that's propelling us to want to grow and evolve, there is a part of that that is a longing to know the truth. It's a part of us that wants to strip off the perceptual filters and see things as they are. And it's a part of us that wants to come into right relationship to reality as it is. And this is often heightened because we've studied spiritual literature and we've done spiritual practice, and throughout time all the mystics, all the realizers, the enlightened sages have told us that humanity is living in illusion, that there are these veils which prevent us from seeing reality as it is. And of course what the mystics have all said is that those veils can be removed, that it's possible to clear away the distorting filters on our perception, on our knowing, and come to a capacity to see things as they are, unadorned, unbiased, undistorted, to come face to face with the truth, with reality with a capital R. Even the word enlightenment itself is a metaphor, right, for coming into clarity, into clear the light of clear seeing, a movement out of the darkness of ignorance and delusion into the light of truth, wisdom, clarity. So on the one hand, we're these postmoderns with our healthy skepticism and doubt about truth. And on the other hand, we're human beings with awakening spiritual hearts, with a spiritual impulse that senses a possibility to truly know, to see, to be here in the world with our eyes unstained, to really see it as it is, so we can engage with it as it is and live a life that's aligned with something more true, to be true, the longing to be true. And I don't want you to take my word for that. I want to actually invite us for a moment to just sense into the nature of our own deepest spiritual longing. I just want you to take a moment with me right now. And just make space for the part of you that longs for spiritual awakening, for depth, for God, for enlightenment, whatever word you would use, for your higher evolutionary potential to emerge, for a transformed way of being in alignment. So what is it that you're longing for? At one level, often the first level we become aware of when we begin to just feel into this impulse, the spiritual impulse or yearning, is it feels like we're longing for a certain feeling. We want, there's a feeling of connectedness, of connection, of love, of unity, of deep peace and fulfillment or ease of being. There's this kind of sense that I just want to come into this sense of fullness and wholeness. And freedom. So make room for that, because that's a big part of the longing. It's natural. But what I want to invite you to do is just imagine that you had that. So let's not make that part of our longing wrong in any way. Let's sense that that's a part of the impulse toward wholeness, toward the divine. But just imagine for a moment that you had that completely. So imagine that whatever that most perfect, holy, sacred, full, loving, unified, connected feeling is, at the high 100 volume up, 100%, full intensity. Imagine you've had that feeling all the time. That fullness, that sense of unbearable connectedness, perfect love, overflowing, without end. So you are basically an ecstasy light bulb at this point. It's just, you know, your nervous system can barely take the positive feeling. It's so intense, and it never stops. So the question is, then what? Meaning, is the spiritual longing really satisfied by that perfection of feeling, by that unbearable fullness of being that never wanes? Are you ready to just, you know, at that point, like, okay, I'm there. I got my private nirvana. I'm good, as they say. I'm not longing for anything else. And there's no pull in any direction now. It's just fullness and that's it. And I'm just going to sit here in this forever. It doesn't even matter what I do or what happens because it's so full. Or is there a deeper longing? If so, what is its nature? What is it longing for? Is there a longing to be in deep alignment with something greater, with the universe, with the cosmos, with the divine, with the evolutionary impulse? It's a longing that says, okay, I feel great, but I want my life to mean something, meaning I want it to be, to express something holy, sacred, important, meaningful, purposive. And in that, is there even a longing for truth itself? Like, can you sense a part of the longing that's a longing to be true, or to be right with the universe in a sense, like to be in integrity with the impulse itself, with what's needed, with reality, to know, is there an impulse to know what's really true, to know reality as it is? It's even more important than that perfect ecstasy and fullness and love. To know reality so that my actions will express truth, They will be accurate, adequate to the situation. And it might show up differently for everyone, so I'm not trying to define your longing for you. I'm just exploring some of the contours of it, of its universal nature. But to whatever degree, some dimension of this other part of our spiritual impulse shows up for you, whether it's for alignment, for truth, for clarity, for being able to express something that's needed for something greater. Whatever that is, I just want you to note that. And as we go through this evening, I want to invite you to just anchor yourself in that, ground yourself in that dimension of your spiritual impulse. So I would say that the reason we're coded in a sense with that kind of longing, with that kind of impulse, is that the deeper point of enlightenment or of spiritual awakening is not so that we can experience a profound state of being, but it's to enable us to become sane. To become sane, conscious human beings who are capable of seeing clearly, seeing things as they are, and responding in a way that's helpful, that's constructive, that's evolutionary, that's in service to the whole in every circumstance and situation we encounter. And that ultimately, it's this kind of alignment, this kind of sanity, that is what gives us the experience of that kind of fullness and freedom of being that comprises the other aspect of our longing. That it's not that we won't have that experience of wholeness and fullness, but it tends to be a byproduct of this deeper thing, which is coming into an ability to see clearly and to be motivated in such a way, to have a clarity of motivation that enables us to respond to the truth we see. I mean, and to take it down out of even mystical, spiritual, lofty, what is your deepest longing language, I just think deep down, we all want our lives to make sense. We want life to make sense. We want to have a sense that we are living in alignment, which just means we're doing the right things for the right reasons at the right time. And we want other people to live that way, don't we? We think about what frustrates us about the people we know. It's when they're not doing that. They're not doing the right things for the right reasons at the right time. So we long for a world in which everybody is aligned with truth. Everybody's seeing things as they are and therefore responding to things as they are in a way that's adequate to the situation, that's appropriate to the context. And we sense that if everybody did that, if we could all just live that way, what a wonderful world it would be, right? What a magical human community we would have. There's no longer competing agendas, no longer competing perceptions and perspectives. Of course, we all have different vantage points on reality. But what if we all just wanted to see the truth more than we wanted to prove our own beliefs to be true, more than we wanted to have our own agendas win out? What if everybody just said, I just want to see the truth and I want to live in accord with it. I want to find out what it is and I want to do that together. And I trust we can find our way if we all come from that. Yes, a lot of complexity we would have to navigate on the way, but you can begin to see the simplicity of human relationship that can emerge from that kind of purity of motive. So what this means is that we want to come to a place where we're living in the real world, where we're in touch with the real world, not the world of our projections, not the world of our biases, not the world of our preconceptions, our assumptions, our delusions, our illusions. I want to see life as it is, in this moment and the next moment and the next. Because if we could, we would always find our way. We'd always be able to find our way through in a really sane way, a really constructive, helpful, evolutionary way. And what a service we would be to everyone else in the whole process. There's only one problem. The problem is that we are wired to avoid the truth on so many levels, in so many different ways. In our current evolutionary state, we are built at around, we have a fundamental disposition of avoidance of reality. We have deep mechanisms of self-deception that are operative below consciousness, meaning they're going on unawares to us in all kinds of ways all the time. There's a fundamental way in which the presence of fear and desire distorts our perception. If we want something, we are going to distort our thinking in support of getting it. We'll look at some examples of that tonight. There are also ways that have any attachment to self-image is going to distort our ability to see ourselves clearly. There's a way in which any investment in any belief system at all, in any idea that we hold too tightly, is going to distort our ability to see information that challenges that belief. And I'm just scratching the surface here. I mean, there are cognitive psychologists have identified what they call cognitive biases in human beings, just ways in which we are wired that where we tend to distort reality. And just to kind of update myself on this, earlier today I took a peek on Wikipedia just to look at like the kind of list of cognitive biases that have been identified. I thought I was going to find 20 something. There were like, I didn't count. It looked like about 75 to 100 listed of different, very specific biases that have been identified that people tend to hold. And I'm just going to, I think I'll actually mention a few of them just to give you an example. But so tonight, so, and then of course there are the ego defense mechanisms, which is first mentioned by Sigmund Freud and then kind of laid out, cataloged or indexed by Anna Freud, his daughter, and have, been further elaborated on since, but there's a whole list of those, which are all ways that we bring ourselves out of touch with reality, some of which are direct distortions of perception. And so what I want to take us through tonight is I know we all probably kind of know this, I mean, this is even colloquial knowledge, right? We see what we want to see, people are more afraid of the truth. It's common knowledge in a sense, but I want to get us all related to some of the different dimensions of what it is that takes us out of contact with reality and truth, so that we can, because what's possible is that we can bring consciousness to these areas, and then they begin to lose their influence. And to the degree that we bring a lot of consciousness to these distorting factors or mechanisms, they can lose all their influence once all becomes fully conscious. And so we're going to do some exercises tonight. It's not just going to be one big long lecture, but I'm going to take you through some reflection exercises around these different ways in which we all distort perception and take ourselves out of touch with truth. And then we'll move on to looking at how wisdom emerges and what this wisdom, mysterious wisdom faculty is that can emerge on the other side of all this, and how we begin to make way for that. And then we'll talk a little bit about the collective dimension and implications of all this. So first we're going to look at some of the ways in which we distort reality. I'm just going to give some examples just to make sure we're all looking at the same thing. So some of the simpler examples are some of these cognitive biases. And like I said, if you want to look it up, cognitive biases, and on Wikipedia, for instance, you'll see this giant list of so many. And if you read through them, they're kind of complex, but you'll recognize them in your own experience of yourself and others. But one thing I remember learning about way back in college was it was under study of cognitive dissonance theory. But and they have a simple name for this now. They call it the post-purchase rationalization. But basically, it's once you've made a decision, or even if someone's made it for you, if you notice, what happens is you'll start trying to reassure yourself that it was the best possible decision. So in other words, they've studied human beings and seen that prior to making a purchase, for instance, like if you're trying to buy a car and you're weighing two different cars, should we get this one or the Toyota or the Honda? Should we get the, whatever? So you're going back and forth. And prior to making the purchase, people tend to be much more objective about the cars. They'll kind of be able to look and say, well, this one has these positive benefits and it has these drawbacks. This one has these pros and these cons, and they can look at it fairly objectively because they haven't decided yet. They're weighing the two, and they want to be as clear seeing as possible. But then once they actually buy one, they finally decide, okay, we're going to go for this one. Then if they are given the same test immediately after the purchase, not like they've owned the car and seen how wonderful it is, but just after they've made the decision, and they don't remember the test they took before, and they go through it again, and they will rate the car they bought much higher than the car they didn't buy, whereas before they bought it, they would rate them the same. Why is that? Because we want to convince ourselves that we did the right thing. We want to convince ourselves we made a good choice. So, why? So we don't have to bear the discomfort of wondering, did I get the better one or did I not get the good one? Should I have gotten the other one? We want to remove all doubt and just, convince ourselves we did the right thing. And you can see that little mechanism playing out in all kinds of ways. It's not just a purchase thing, right? But it's any kind of decision where you're trying to decide, which way do I go? This or that, this or that. The moment you've made it, all kinds of factors converge to what? Distort your perception of the validity of your decision to make it seem like you did the right thing. Why is that dangerous? Because what if you didn't do the right thing? What if it was a terrible decision? And a week later, all this data starts pouring in, convincing you that, or revealing that it was a bad decision. But you've put all this energy into convincing yourself it's the right decision, and you're going to what? Avoid and deny all that new information that's coming in because you're invested in in believing that you've made a good decision. You don't want the discomfort of having to question it, challenge it, open it up again. That's one of the 100 or so cognitive biases. You recognize it? Okay. And then some of these biases, we tend to go different ways. There's an optimism bias, where some people tend to be overly optimistic, meaning they unrealistically estimate the likelihood of a good outcome in situations. Why? Because they don't want to bear the insecurity of not knowing whether it's a good way to go. So they're beforehand, they're like, oh, it'll be fine. It'll be good. It'll be fine. Other people have a pessimism bias, often people with some depression, and they overestimate the likelihood of a negative outcome in a way that's unrealistic because they, whatever, they have a negative bias. So, often we're one side of that or the other. People don't tend to be that objective, rational, just, oh, it's actually, I'm going to just look at the situation as it is and perceive it accurately. And we've all know about the kind of experimenter bias or expectation bias, what they call the observer expectancy effect, which is that if you're a researcher and you expect a certain result or you want to get a certain result, therefore you'll unconsciously manipulate the experiment or unconsciously misinterpret the data in order to find the answer you were looking for. I mean, we all know about this from science, but we all know that that's also plays out in life in general, right? It's a colloquial thing. We see what we want to see. So we look for the data that will reinforce our preconceived belief about what's so, about our hypotheses. Why is that a problem? It's a big problem because it means you're not going to be taking things in with any kind of objectivity. You're going to be, skewing the picture always. Anyway, I'll just mention another couple here that are interesting. So there's an attention, what they call the attentional bias, which is it's a tendency for that if it's the tendency, I'll just read it from Wikipedia and explain it, but they say the tendency of emotionally dominant stimuli in one's environment to preferentially draw and hold our attention and therefore to neglect relevant data in making our judgment. So in other words, if something's just got a lot of emotional charge to it, we'll tend to overweight its relevance because there's just a lot of emotional intensity around it and it therefore captures our attention. This is probably how advertising works, right? You watch those ads and they throw all this emotionally charged imagery and, content and promise at you so that you will unrealistically evaluate that product and associate it with all that positive emotional stimuli, when really the product, that can of beer or coffee, has nothing to do with that imagery, right? I'm just guessing here, but it's probably that same kind of thing. So these are all ways in which we're irrational, meaning we're not really, we tend to think of ourselves as these very rational creatures, but we're so biased in so many ways that are happening below the radar. So those are just a few examples of these cognitive biases. I'll let you explore them yourself because they're just one of the ways. So I'll look at some of the others here. You've probably heard me speak at some point about our investment in our self-image and how that tends to distort our perception. And this is often when I'm talking about ego, I speak about how if you have a story about yourself being a certain way, if you have a picture that you have invested in of the kind of person you are, you are going to be compelled to avoid any information that challenges your self-image, that contradicts your story. So inherently, having any investment in seeing yourself in a particular way is going to lead to distorted perceptions. For instance, if I'm emotionally invested in a self-image of being intelligent, I'm going to avoid information that suggests I might be wrong about something because I'm so invested in being smart and seeing myself as smart. And of course, being seen by others as smart tends to go along with it, but doesn't have to. It's mainly from my image of myself. And that means I'm also going to defend my conclusions about something, even if they're not very well founded and I don't really know what I'm talking about. I'm going to tend to defend my conclusions just in order to be able to defend my self-image of being the smart one. Or let's say I have a story about myself that I'm a peace-loving person. I have bumper stickers on my car that say visualize world peace. I believe in peace. I go to peace rallies, whatever, I believe I'm a peace-loving person. And that's great. I mean, I'm not in any way denigrating doing all those things, but I'm saying it's one thing to be a peace-loving person. That's great. Be a peace-loving person. Be an intelligent person. Whatever. These things themselves are fine. But the point is, if I am convinced that I'm a peace-loving person and I have a self-image that I'm a peaceful, loving person, what's the problem with that? I'm not going to be able to see the ways in which I might be aggressive, particularly in the case of the peace-loving person, the ways in which I'm probably passive-aggressive, because I wouldn't, dare do anything too actively aggressive because it would contradict my self-image. So I'll be kind of passive-aggressive and inwardly hostile and all these things, but I won't see it. I won't let myself see it because it would contradict my self-image. So I'll avoid, deny. If there's evidence that I'm being aggressive, I'll rationalize it. I'll justify it. I'll tell a different story about it. I'll give it a different explanation, anything to not rattle that self-image. Or if I believe I'm a selfless, egoless person, I'm a spiritual person and I'm selfless and egoless. I've been meditating 30 years and I'm very self, no self. I don't even use the first person pronoun anymore. I'm so selfless. What's going to happen? Any ways in which I might still be self-centered, I'll be blind to. And even if other people point them out, I'll defend and deny. So there's all the things that have to do with self-image. And we'll do an exercise on that a little bit later. And then that leads into just a general discussion of the ego defense mechanisms, which, as I spoke about earlier, so these are all the ways in which the ego structure defends itself against uncomfortable realities. And they're not all ways of distorting truth directly. A lot of them are, but they all take us away from direct contact with the painful aspects of reality that we don't want to see, that we don't want to bear, that we don't want to be in touch with. Because we don't want the insecurity, the upset of those truths. So we have all these built-in mechanisms to distort reality, forms of self-deception. And these are commonplace in the culture. Many of them, not all of them, but like denial, right? We all know about denial. Somebody gets diagnosed with an illness and immediately they just begin denying it's not true, couldn't be true, must be a mistake, they must not have they must not have read the results right. Denial. Or you get strong evidence that a loved one is betraying you, whether it's cheating on you, stealing from you, speaking negatively about you behind your back, somebody who you trusted, you liked, you get this evidence. That's not true. And the ego defense rushes in denying it. No, it couldn't be true. That's not them. They're not that way. Deny, deny, deny. So we all know that one. We've all seen it. We all, of course, know about projection, right? We don't want to see something about ourselves, maybe some shadow element of ourselves, something that we perceive as negative or that's out of alignment with our self-image. So we project it onto someone else. And we say, oh, there. That person is so, we're greedy and we're looking at everybody else and look how greedy they are, or whatever. Homophobia is an example often given around projection. People who, actually have homoerotic impulses themselves can't bear it, doesn't fit with their self-image or what they've, been told they should be or whatever, so they become aggressive toward homosexuality. We've all heard about repression and suppression, which are different, subtly different. And I'm going to talk about the difference, but they're two different ways in which we push uncomfortable facts or uncomfortable feelings out of consciousness entirely. So we don't have to live with the discomfort of them. And you can see why why these, in a kind of conventional sense, are in some ways healthy adaptations, right? It's not that, in a kind of conventional, unenlightened, egoic sense of a person just trying to adapt and get through life with all of its complexities and difficulties and pain. Sometimes pushing a painful event out of consciousness is what enables a person to get through life to the next day. So we're not necessarily even dissing all of these mechanisms as much as just trying to get related to, wow, look how we're designed to avoid and deny so many things, to not see things as they are. And of course, we all know rationalization, right? Where we come up with a rational explanation for something in order to cover up what the real reason it happened. Like, we lose our job because really we weren't doing a good job. But we can't bear facing our incompetence or our poor performance. So we make up a story about our boss or that organization and why it was, they didn't see how great I was or whatever. But instead of facing the truth, wow, you know what? I was actually really lazy. I didn't really care. I didn't pay attention. I didn't work hard. I wasn't suited for the, whatever it is. We rationalize events, circumstances all the time to create a plausible explanation that doesn't implicate us. Again, this is, you can see how it loops into the self-image inquiry again. Not all of them do, but some of the defenses are really about self-image like that. And I'd encourage you to read about defense mechanisms online too, if you haven't, rather than go through an exhaustive list here. But even if you learned them in psychology 101 in college or whatever, revisit them now from your spiritual perspective and see that they're very insightful about human nature. You go, wow, look at how we are. It's true. We do all those things. And some of them are more complex than the ones I described, but I'm not going to try to take us into complexity because it's not necessary for the point here. Because really, the point here is getting related to just how deeply wired we are for distortion. And therefore, really, in a sense, why this postmodern insight is accurate, right? This insight that we're always interpreting and distorting reality according to our biases and preconceptions that people started to get really clear about back in the early 20th century. The great postmoderns like Foucault and Derrida, these guys, this is what they were on about, and it's true. But the spiritual question is, to what degree is it possible to actually see clearly without distortion? It's okay, so we have all these ways we're wired to distort, to avoid, to not see things as they are. But does that really mean we can't? Are we doomed to live in a hall of mirrors, in a web of illusion of our own minds making? Or is there a way out? You probably know what my answer is. There's a way out. But I want to clarify here, because if we're going to talk about, well, how do we come to see the truth? How do we remove the veils of illusion so that we can come to see things as they are? We need to realize I'm not talking about attaining any kind of omniscience, okay? And I don't even just mean that in a supernatural sense. Like, I'm not, like, yes, I'm not saying that there's some supernatural omniscience that we're aiming for. And I'm also not saying that if you just remove all of your own distorting influences, that therefore you will always see the truth with a capital T in every moment. Because let's face it, we might not always have all the information we need to know what's going on in a given situation to interpret it accurately. Right? You might come walking into a room and, you know, there's a man and a woman standing there and she's shouting at him and he's shouting at her. And then he, you know, kind of slaps her across the face. And you immediately think, oh my God, this man and woman are fighting. And you go running up there and grab the guy and, you know, what do you do? You know, and this whole thing. And they say, hey, you screwed us up. We were practicing for my play. You know, it was a skit and I didn't really hit her. That was just a little fake hit. You know, you didn't know. It wasn't that your response was wrong necessarily. It might have been very purely motivated, but you don't necessarily always have all the data that you need. That's inherent in reality. You might. But so let me clarify though, because see, a lot of people go there where I just went and they say, therefore, see, Craig, you know, we can't really know the truth. We're always just subject to our interpretation. And so we just need to let go of any notion of knowing the truth. But what I'm saying is, well, there's a further step we can take. Because what is possible? And the question is, how can we remove any obstacles to seeing the truth that are inside of us, that are internal? In other words, can we identify and then transcend or go beyond any distortions that we're imposing on the situation? Is it possible to come to a place where we're able to meet situations free from the influence of our preconceptions, our preconceived ideas, free from the influence of our ego defenses, because we've seen through them and come to a place where we're now more conscious and awake than the level at which those defenses are operating? Is it possible to become so deeply aligned with the impulse toward truth, or another, to put it more simply, so interested in the truth? So much more interested in seeing the truth than we are in defending anything or maintaining anything, that we're no longer in the way of seeing clearly. We're no longer in our own way. We're no longer the obstacle. That's the spiritual question. And that's the question that points out of the web of illusion and into the potential for clear seeing, for a deeper knowing, for the emergence of holistic wisdom and enlightened intuition. So how do we remove the filters over our lens so we can see reality as it is? So I want to just speak to, in a sense, before we get into some of these exercises, I want to speak to just a few of what we might kind of call the basic stances of a life devoted to truth, a life committed to truth, a life aligned with truth. And the basics, the first, the really most fundamental stance, and it's not something we can just assert, it's something we have to consistently inquire into and question in ourselves till we to get to a place where our motivation around this is really clear. And the stance is, I want to know the truth more than anything else, more than I want anything else. I want to know the truth more than I want to defend any belief, more than I want to feel good all the time. My own teacher used to say, you just need to be more interested in what's true than in how you feel. Very simple way of putting it. Be more interested in seeing the truth than in how you feel. Because moment by moment, the truth might make you very uncomfortable. So if you're more interested in the truth than in feeling comfortable, you're going to be okay. If you're more interested in being comfortable than seeing the truth, you're going to distort reality. So a basic primary stance to cultivate is to come to a place where I don't care what I see. I don't care what it reveals. I don't care what it's going to require from me in terms of action and alignment with it. I want to know the truth. I want to see things as they are more than anything else. If we can find that simplicity in ourselves, we'll discover a very pure motive emerging. Very wholesome, deeply aligned motivation. Now, to take that down to into kind of practice or down to the ground one step. This next layer of that stance is, and therefore, I'm willing to face everything and avoid nothing. Now, in my own teacher's teaching, this was the third tenet of his teachings, face everything and avoid nothing. That's how he framed it. And it's such a good frame. I'm going to preserve it here right now for all of us. I'm willing to face everything and avoid nothing. And he often said that's the most powerful spiritual practice there is. More powerful than meditation, prayer, chanting, prostrations, circumambulating Mount Everest, whatever. Face everything and avoid nothing at all times. Regardless of what it means, regardless of what I see, I just want to face it all. I want to be in touch with reality. I want to see it. So I'll face anything uncomfortable about myself, anything uncomfortable about reality, anything I don't want. Truth comes my way that I don't want to be true. No, say it isn't so. I'll face it. I won't avoid anything because I want to be that naked before the truth. And this is, in some sense, that alone is enough, but there's a further layer to this which has to do with with faith, in a sense. I spoke last month some about faith in love. So let's look at faith from the point of view of truth. What does it mean to have faith in the truth? Because there's a big dimension of spiritual life that's about having faith in the truth. And what it means is it's that I have faith that if I always face the truth as it is, if I always turn toward the truth, no matter how uncomfortable it might be, no matter what the implications might be, that if I always face the truth, I'll be able to make better decisions. Why? Because they'll be informed by truth, not delusion. And therefore, because I'm doing that, I will be living in greater alignment with reality, with things as they are. And this faith is that doing that will lead to the best possible outcome for the greater good, including my greatest good. Even if I might have to sacrifice some things I want along the way. Even if it means I'm not going to get what I want right now or what I think I need. But I'm going to face the truth. And I have a faith that doing so is going to lead to a better life.